This is Radio Influence.
Got him in the white trunks. He hurt him.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the count. What? Hey, here's Lincoln's submission. And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the February 14th, 2018 edition of the MMA Report podcast. Hopefully you're having a good day. Daniel and I, we've got another jam-packed podcast for you coming this week as we are going to recap what happened at UFC 221 this past weekend in Australia. Plus, we'll get you ready for this weekend's Bellator 194 and UFC Fight Night 126. Going to have three interviews with fighters that are part of those fight cards. You hear from Liam McGarry, Anna Houlton, and Joby Sanchez. Plus, we'll talk about some of the latest news and notes going on in the world of MMA. Of course, you can always listen to this podcast on RadioInfluence.com. Also, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Really do appreciate it if you give us a rating and review, particularly on Apple Podcasts, to let us know what you think about the podcast. Also, going to answer a listener question about USADA as well. Daniel, how's it going, man?
It's going quite well, Jason. There is no better way I would like to spend a Valentine's Day than talking to you about UFC 221, about the Bellator card, about UFC, about USADA. I mean, what a romantic way to spend Valentine's Day. How pumped are you for the big V-Day?
It's another day to me.
Okay, for you, but what about your significant other?
You should love your significant other every day of the year, not just like treat her special that one day of the year. You gotta do it every day of the year, man.
Oh, you see, you're speaking like a veteran who's not scared of a loss, whereas I am someone who is currently on the UFC contender fight series, and I just every win matters. Whereas you're just a Vitor Belfort. You know, you can lose five in a row and you'll get booked again. But I am much more hungrier. I got to prove myself. I still don't know what I'm going to do to buy stuff for a certain someone. I'm certainly going to spend a lot of money, though. I can tell you that much. But, maybe I'll get her a UFC Fight Pass subscription.
Well, apparently fighting does solve everything if you listen to their advertising. So, I'll be cooking my wife a dinner. You know, it's kind of a low-key day for us, but that's just what we do on our side of things. But let me first, we want to start off this podcast by going back to last weekend. UFC 221 on Saturday night. I went out to and watched the Tampa Bay Lightning game. If you did not see the save by Vazzy with the behind-the-back save, go to YouTube. You'll find that save. Even if you're not a hockey fan, you can see how great of a save that was. But after the game was over, went across the street to a sports bar that I knew was going to have the UFC pay-per-view. And we ended up sitting inside. They have a big outside area. So I can only talk about what I saw inside. Man, at least where I was at, did not seem like there was a lot of people paying attention to the fights.
Well, it definitely depends what time you were watching the fight, like what fight was on the television. Because I feel like if you were with people while Tai Tuivasa was just performing an open face surgery on Cyril Asker, there'd probably be more people paying attention. But if you were observing this during the Mark Hunt Curtis Blaydes fight, I certainly would understand why you would have very few people paying attention at the TV. Like, was this a constant thing the entire night? People weren't watching UFC 221, or did people perk up when they saw like a dope submission from Tyson Pedro? Or was it just constant even during the main event? The focus wasn't there.
It just wasn't there for at least the place that I was at. I just didn't see it. You know, before the event started, there was a tweet that I saw from Adam Martin, and he was talking about Boston Pizza, up where he lives in Canada, was no longer showing the event. And I responded to something he said about it, and kind of outlined of why a place may not be showing the pay-per-view anymore, which ended up getting a lot of likes. And I'll just, for people who did not see that tweet, I was basically just saying is clearly that business probably has said that there's just not enough revenue coming in on fight nights in comparison to the amount of money that they do have to pay to get the pay-per-view. I mean, look, and this is a fight card that, could you imagine if Luke Rockhold could not come to an agreement with Yoel Romero on the fine, and if that fight would not have taken place?
Oh, man, that would be one of the all-time disasters for the UFC, but they wouldn't have done that much less of a buy rate, I think, Jason. I think it would have been 10,000 instead of 15,000 buys. I mean, obviously, it would be dramatic. Like, you would probably have to cancel the card, right? Even the day – I mean, I don't know if you would or wouldn't. Is it? It's certainly not possible to make that fight free, right? Like, I mean, what are the options for the UFC if something like that happens, you think?
At that point, I think they have no choice but to keep it on pay-per-view. But I remember last Friday, I was extremely busy with stuff I was doing. And I remember seeing my timeline as the weigh-ins were going on, because the weigh-ins, the way they worked in Australia for this one, it was like the old-school weigh-ins. 24 hours before the event started was the official weigh-in, and we saw how kind of everything went down, and I saw people tweeting about Yoel Romero missing weight. And, I mean, first off, so I end up, you know, I see all the tweets, so I turn on FS1. First off, can we please stop the interview with Fighter right after they hop off the scale when they look, when they're at their absolute worst? I mean, I'm like, that does nothing for, you know, to help the fighter promote the fight. B, come on, FS1, you got to ask Luke Rockhold if he's going to take the fight if Yoel Romero's not going to make weight. And then I end up tweeting essentially along the lines, if I am Luke Rockhold and his manager, which is Bob Cook, when I'm starting the negotiations for what the fine's going to be, the number I start off with is at 50%. And the low number would be 30%, which is what they ended up going for. But it sounds like it wasn't until actually the day of the fight that there was an agreement between Rockhold's team, Romero's team, and the UFC. I mean, and I think that's what a lot of people may or may not understand, is that because you're so used to seeing a news story where, you know, it's a 20% fine, all that, but that has to actually be agreed upon by all the parties. And I remember when Justin Gaethje fought Melvin Gallar in the World Series of Fighting, and they went into the negotiation process, and when I heard Gaethje's camp said 50%, I was amazed. I'm like, no way Gallar's going to accept it. They come out of the room like 2 minutes later, and Gallar accepted a 50% fine. And I remember talking to Trevor Whitman, of course, as a coach of Justin, right after the negotiation ended, and he said, yeah, we knew that Melvin was going to take a 50% fine. So, you know, when you look at the disclosed pay of Yoel Romero for previous events, Luke Rockhold walked away with, even though he ended up losing the fight, he walked away with a nice little chunk of money for Yoel not making weight.
It kind of shows you kind of have to always surround yourself with just smart people, because you never know when you're going to be put in those situations. Because, like, if you're a fighter, your primary focus is cutting your weight and making fight day. So, like, you got to have good people around you to get that money in your bank account. I mean, Justin Gaethje's guys were ready to get 50%. And I don't think they would have gotten 50%, but it's a part of negotiating where you do start at a high price point. And maybe if that was what he did, or maybe he actually did do that, but he would have ended up with like 40% or 35 or whatnot. But, you know, it is a situation where Luke Rockhold definitely did the UFC a favor. Obviously, Yoel Romero was doing the UFC a favor just taking this fight. But I think Yoel Romero did the entire MMA world a favor by missing weight, because for the love of God, we do not have another interim title. That to me is the big win. That's the big positive. Obviously, the negative is we had a fighter miss weight in the main event. But the big positive, Jason, is because Yoel Romero missed weight, we don't have an interim middleweight champion. And that in itself is a big victory, even though Yoel Romero's next fight will probably be for another interim middleweight championship, unless Robert Whittaker gets healthy.
Yeah, I mean, it does sound like Whittaker, the target is for him to return this summer, which, you know, that has become a little bit of the question mark is, even, you know, should Yoel Romero get the next title shot, be, you know, after missing weight for this matchup. And his manager, Malky Kawa, was on Luke Thomas's show on Monday of this week, and he said that, look, because of the short notice fight, and really, he said once Yoel took this fight, it was nothing but weight cutting for him, you know. And so, what, you know, I'm sure a lot of people will take that as excuse, but, you know, as Max Holloway likes to say, it is what it is. But, you know, that has become the debate of, you know, should Yoel get the next title matchup? And I understand why someone would say Yoel shouldn't be as kind of a penalty. Now, I mean, obviously, you know, losing 30% of his purse, that probably took a big chunk out of his pay, and I'm sure he's feeling that money right now. But to me, I don't know if there's a great another option to fight Robert Whittaker. I mean, you know, I think the three guys that you point to are Chris Weidman, Kelvin Gastelum, and Jacare Souza. When it comes to Jacare and Chris Weidman, I feel like they need another win or two to put themselves in that line. That leaves Kelvin Gastelum. And can you give Kelvin Gastelum a title shot when he just lost to Chris Weidman in, what, July of last year?
Yeah, I would definitely put Chris Weidman number three among those that group. And I think it's a pretty big distance. I think it would just, unfortunately for Kelvin Gastelum, his victories have well. I mean, his wins over Bisping, Tim Kennedy, Johnny Hendricks, and Nate Marquardt. Those are his last four wins. I mean, he has beat a who's who of, man, they were great a few years ago. I think, and that's being really harsh to Michael Bisping, I must say. But I do think Michael has aged quite a bit since being champion, and he benefited off of fighting Dan Henderson for his one title defense. I think Jacare and Weidman could very well get title shots, but I would say that Yoel Romero has a lot more juice, no pun intended, than either of those two when it comes to being a challenger. I know the one pushback, I think, well, aside from the fact that he did miss weight in this main event, the one pushback for a Romero fight is just that we literally saw him last summer take on Robert Whittaker.
Yeah.
And it was a close fight. It was a great fight. But I think that's the pushback. And I will say that, the only way there's probably a lot of momentum for a challenger for Robert Whittaker is probably if Robert Whittaker takes more time off. If he doesn't, if there's a fight between Romero versus either Weidman or Jacare or something like that, maybe that contender has consecutive wins in a row and they have more juice, but that's not likely. What's likely is Whittaker defends his title. And I know we are prisoners of the moment all the time, but I will say, just looking at the resumes of everybody, Romero's resume to me is quite a bit higher, especially when you look at the fact that, like, his only loss in the UFC is to Robert Whittaker. And he has finished Weidman, he has finished Rockhold, finished Machida, and he has a win over Jacare Souza. I mean, in this fight against Luke Rockhold, Yoel did not look great early on. It was kind of a tentative first round, looked a lot better in the second round, and just destroyed Rockhold. So Romero's power looked great. He destroyed a great middleweight in Luke Rockhold. And at the end of the day, you know, Romero is a violent, exciting fighter. And, you know, the only thing he assaults more than people's faces is his own trunks with fecal matter. Because he pooped himself one time.
Yeah, that is for older fans of MMA. What I mean by older fans, like 3 years ago.
Yeah, well, 3 years ago or 300 events ago.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for Luke Rockhold, it would not surprise me. I mentioned, I thought he got off to a decent start in this matchup, but, you know, it just shows the power he has. And Luke, putting a tweet out there, you know, calling Yoel just a man made of steel, and just a big knockout from Yoel Romero. But, you know, Luke, prior to this event, had talked about moving up to 205, and I think he probably got a good possibility that his next fight is at 205.
Man, I think the 205-pound division is getting a lot better than we think. I think when we think of the 205-pound division, we still allow kind of what it was 3 or 4 years ago to be our vision, because Luke Rockhold taking on someone like Misha Cirkunov or Corey Anderson may not end too well for him, because he is kind of a skinny guy at middleweight. I don't know if he has – I mean, I don't know like what his bone density is or whatever, but I do get a sense that against some of these, you know, really in their prime, bigger light heavyweights, he might struggle, Jason. I don't know if it's going to be really easy for Luke Rockhold to pick away at 205. Granted, I guess the counterpoint is we literally just saw Volkan Ozdemir get a championship opportunity, and Rockhold has been a stalwart at 185. So I would say if the weight cut is really hard for Luke Rockhold, there's probably value in moving up to 205. But sometimes I think the answer is just staying where you're at. Mm-hmm. But it does seem like at the end of the day, like all the momentum of what Luke wants to do is go to 205. And I don't know, man. I just think sometimes it comes down to staying in your own division. I mean, do you think this is a like an avenue for him to? You think he's going to be a better fighter at 205 than 185?
I don't know. I mean, I think part of this probably has to do with the weight cut and maybe just, you know, tired of going down, you know, 185 pounds. My guess is he probably walks around at probably around 205. That'd be my guess. You know, but, you know, the question mark going into this matchup with Luke was, hey, you know, is the chin? You know, a lot of people were questioning it, and you see it here. You know, now he's lost two of his last three fights, both by knockout. Of course, the other one being against Michael Bisping. But, you know, look, I think that if DC's not going to come back to 205, it does make a lot of sense. You know, I do kind of wonder when you have a corner where two of the guys are really not with you for the most part during fight camp, and that being Javier Mendez and Bob Cook, you know, when, you know, Greg Jones and Henry Hoof were the other two cornermen, and obviously they were around Luke the entire time. I do wonder how much that has an effect, but congratulations to Yoel Romero. But, you know, to me, it really seems that most of the talk of this fight card is actually a tweet from Curtis Blaydes after this fight is over. And, of course, if you have not seen that tweet, he said, quote, "If you want to see two guys stand and bang for the entire fight, there's these sports called boxing and kickboxing. I hear they're pretty fun to watch." And obviously that is his way of responding to the negative tweets that fans do send to fighters, which sometimes there's just, you know, maybe why as an athlete, maybe you really shouldn't look at your Twitter mentions. But I understand where Curtis is coming from, but I also understand there is a part of the fan base out there that just doesn't love the way Curtis Blaydes won that fight. But I don't blame him for what he did, because he put himself in the best position to succeed.
Yeah, he was not he's not a dynamic striker. That was very evident in his fight against Mark Hunt. It seemed like when he was standing, it was just surviving. You know, don't get knocked out, don't get knocked out. Throw a little bit. It's not like Mark Hunt was out there blitzing him like K1 or whatnot, but it was clear that Mark Hunt was just several leagues above him. So he did what he needed to do to get a victory, and he's really good at taking fighters down. Now the counter to Curtis's tweet is like, yeah, true, whatever. That is true. But like, bro, you're the fifth ranked UFC heavyweight and you got 3,793 followers on Twitter. Like, dude, you're the fifth ranked guy in the UFC's heavyweight division and you have that small of a social media following. It's probably because you have a reputation of being a boring fighter. And regardless of like that one tweet is not going to cause people to start caring about lay and pray fighters like that. Like I don't understand that. Cause at the end of the day, Curtis Blaydes' job, I would assume, is to do two things. Like, one, win fights; two, get a golden jet ski. You know, you want lots of money, and the way you get lots of money is you become a star. And I just don't know if becoming a star, like a part of the roadmap to becoming a star or becoming marketable, is telling people that they're stupid for not liking something. Like, you can be impressed by a fighter's skill, and I certainly am by Curtis Blaydes, and to get to where he is at in the heavyweight division is pretty damn impressive. But I will simply say, it's really hard to manufacture excitement. It's either exciting or it's not. And that fight against Mark Hunt certainly wasn't.
I mean, look, I was, you know, watching the fights with a buddy of mine, and he wasn't a fan of how, you know, the fight went down. But you understand why Curtis goes there. And, of course, after it, you know, he talks about how he only has one fight left on his deal. And, you know, if, you know, essentially he's, you know, and he's just, I mean, he's a prize fighter. He's trying to get the most money he can, mentions that he would listen to Bellator. But, you know, they also, you know, and I saw a tweet earlier late last week where it was talking about, you know, kind of these things you thought of them may say like 5 years ago and just have that are absolutely not true anymore. And, you know, and I saw someone respond with, yeah, the best fighters always fight in the UFC and the UFC doesn't let those guys go or they'll sign those guys. And we clearly know that's not the case. But, you know, you look at Curtis Blaydes and you know, look, the guy is – there's all signs are there. This guy has a chance to contend and fight for the UFC heavyweight title at some point. But it's a – if if that is how he is going to go out and win fights, I don't see the UFC going, we want to pay $700,000 a fight like they pay Mark Hunt.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. And there's a chance that he ends up signing somewhere else once his deal runs out. And it likely comes down to the result of his next fight, because I think his next fight should probably be a big fight. He definitely deserves it. But yeah, the UFC to me would be more eager to pay a similar, you know, just look at a fighter ranked a couple spots under him, like Derek Lewis, who I think it's hard to argue that he is more talented than Curtis Blaydes. I mean, I guess you could argue it either way, but it's not definitive either way for Derek Lewis being better or worse than Curtis Blaydes. But Derek Lewis is above and beyond Curtis when it comes to value to the UFC. Mm-hmm. And value being getting people to watch your product on TV or pay for it. And it's tough, man, because in a perfect world, I think if you're a fan of the quote-unquote sport of MMA, you would want it to be where it's a meritocracy and the best fighters get the money and they get the spot on the card. But that's just not the reality of the situation. I mean, it is very much a business. And it's like Curtis Blaydes is on a – I don't know if he has too much leverage, because he is, at this point, a fighter who has exhibited a high degree of talent, and that talent has not resonated when it comes to becoming a star or becoming relevant in terms of ratings mover or money bringer. But let's not short sell him, because this was a very good performance against Mark Hunt. I mean, definitely the most impressive thing we've seen Curtis Blaydes do so far. And it provided a glimpse of the upside of what Curtis can bring. You know, I think it's going to be tough for him going up against Ngannou, Stipe, Overeem, Verdum, or Cain Velasquez. But everyone else, I think Curtis Blaydes would likely be the favorite against. Maybe not Alexander Volkov, but his takedown game and wrestling is going to be a lot to handle for just about everyone in the heavyweight division.
Yeah, I mean, I think we – I mean, look, his wrestling is dynamic. And I mean, he did some great things on the ground on Saturday night. You have to give him credit for what he's done. But, you know, I think the question that you ultimately have for Curtis is what happens – if he gets in a fight and he's against someone else who has just as good wrestling and he has to win the fight on the feet. I think that's a question mark. You know, I will tell you, I don't know if he would be ready to go by June. I think, was it June 9th is the pay-per-view? June 25th, something like that. The one that's in Chicago that obviously makes all the sense in the world to have Curtis Blaydes on that. But is Cain Velasquez, Curtis Blaydes the fight you do?
Yeah, if Cain, that actually seems perfect to me. Because, again, I think Curtis needs to fight someone who is above him in the rankings. And there's a short – that's a short list. I think Curtis fills the idea of what you want out of Cain Velasquez moving forward. If it's not – it's very clear that his camp and he would like not a tune-up fight, but not a championship fight next. And a fight just to kind of get your bearings about yourself against a high elite level fighter where a win does warrant a title shot. I think that fight sounds perfect. I don't know if the dates are going to line up perfectly, because it does seem like the one deal with Cain is like, there just isn't a set timeline of like, it just like every time you book the fight, it's just you do it with your fingers crossed. So yeah. I think that would be that fight does make a lot of sense, Jason. And it's just it's one I would be very interested, because like you asked the question, what happens when a guy stops Curtis's takedowns? I mean, well, the answer is probably he gets outstruck and knocked out. But Cain Velasquez is going to represent like one of the best answers to that question. Every single round of the fight, he's going to present high level wrestling defense as well as offense. And that's just a great fight for Curtis Blaydes. And you talk about going out on top in a contract. Curtis Blaydes could become a much bigger name overnight with the win, high profile victory over Cain Velasquez. He would become a much bigger name. He would get a whole lot more leverage. So even though today Curtis Blaydes isn't a big star or a star at all, he has put himself in a position to, in his next fight, really up his stock. So even though today it's not super great for the Curtis Blaydes brand, it is worth noting that all of his success inside the cage could potentially lead to something much bigger.
Yeah, you know, and look, I think for Curtis and his manager, Richie Guerrero, I think it's, you know, they've got to really sell the personality of Curtis. And I mean, look, Curtis showed good fight IQ. You know, hey, I'm not going to win this fight on the feet. Let me do what I do best. And, you know, I think we all kind of knew that going into the fight, that's what that could be. Speaking of heavyweights, Tai Tuivasa gets the TKO win in the first round against a real Asker and then takes a, do we call it like a shot of beer out of a tennis shoe?
Yeah, we are so uncultured in America. Apparently this is just normal in Australia, is it not?
I could not. I mean, look, when I was got out of college and for the next 10 years of my life, all I did was, you know, radio marketing where I'm at bars and clubs, you know, doing events. Never had someone come up to me and say, hey, you want to do a shot out of my shoe? And if someone did that, I'd be like, no, I'm good.
Yeah, you probably have athlete's foot. If we've learned anything out of being fans of mixed martial arts and watching the UFC, I think the lesson is that Australia just has the coolest people in the world. Like, every time we get a new Australian face or a face we've seen and they've had success, their post-fight interviews are electric. And we had some great post-fight interviews tonight. I just think, pound for pound, Australians might just be the best human beings on the planet. They are kind of crazy. They are wild. And the crowd was freaking great on this card. Like, it was much better than it deserved to be. And it was awesome for them because they saw most of their hometown guys successful. Obviously, it was somber watching Mark Hunt lose, but a lot of great finishes from fighters they could root for. But, yeah, I mean, two things. One, Tuivasa is awesome. Great heavyweight that I look forward to watching fight. Obviously, the question is what happens if he takes on a high-level wrestler or a medium-level wrestler. And two, gosh, not to be negative, but Asker was out on his feet early in this fight. I think this one should have been stopped quite a bit earlier than it did. I mean, this was just a mauling by Tuivasa over Asker. So the one negative is it did feel like this dragged on just a tad bit too much.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about some negative parts of this fight card, Lee John Ling with the massive eye poke ouch on the ground against Jake Matthews. Of course, Jake goes on to get the win. You mentioned about Tyson Pedro. When you look at the preliminary card, Jussier Formiga, just a beautiful timing of that back fist and then gets the rear naked choke against Ben Wynn. Israel Ansanye got the win, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. The win over Rob Elkinson. Definitely a guy at 185 pounds to pay attention to. I do kind of wonder, I mean, obviously with him, takedown defense, we saw him get taken down in this fight. Rob, you know, really just gassed out. You do wonder, you know, if he starts going up against a bigger grapplers at 185, how does that kind of go for him? But definitely somebody to be excited. And unfortunately, our guy Taruto didn't get the win.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, he's definitely probably on his way out of the UFC, which is super sad.
Oh, come on, Scott Coker. Oh, could you imagine what Scott Coker and Rich Chow could do with him?
Oh my gosh, what they could do with him? I just feel like he would probably have a 14-hour block of on the Paramount Network of just a Taruto video.
I feel like, you know, that Viacom and Bellator would be like, look, Taruto, do what you do. We're not going to censor you here. Do what you do.
Yeah, that sounds like the scariest proposition in the entire history of the sport.
Maybe that means we would be one step closer to the Taruto Ishihara Team Alpha Male reality show.
I mean, that would probably outdraw most things on the Paramount Network, I think.
By the way, speaking of the Paramount Network.
Isn't that show just called Cops?
Yeah, there is. They do well. I don't know if you've watched it. Waco on the Paramount Network, really good.
Yeah, it's like a feel-good story about a hard-working group of people, and it's like fire.
Obviously, right? You were way too young when that was going on. I remember being in school when that was going on, and I've been watching it. Anyone who wants to see it, it's a really good episode. They've done a really good job with it.
I will check that out. That's on the Paramount Network?
Yeah, it's every Wednesday at, I want to say, like 9 or 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, I didn't know that was on the – I'd heard of this show. I know that Tim Riggins from Friday Night Lights is on it as the guy, whatever the – what's that church called?
Oh, well, are you thinking – well, David Koresh was the lead guy. He was the the
what was
leader.
The name of the church? Was it a church deal?
Yeah, they were. I think they call them a religious cult.
Cults, yeah, yeah. That show I heard is great, and shout out to Paramount Network. I'm not a big fan of the name. You know, Spike TV is way better.
It's a little bit of a weird name, and like, you know, like you feel like you need like TV companies need to have like this short name. You know, Spike was good. One word, boom.
Spike, yeah, yeah, and it just felt manly too, right? Spike. But Paramount Network sounds like it should be showing Love Actually all the time, you know? I'm not feeling it at all. But I will say, Jason, the UFC, like, I think MMA might just be dead in a year, you know? I don't know. Do you get that sense? Like this could be, like, one of the last years we ever watched the UFC, because I feel really bad because, like, I enjoyed so many of these fights, dude. I thought there were so many great performances.
I think the thing, the thing I get is I just don't feel the enthusiasm for MMA like there once was. I mean, you know, and look, it's not just a UFC problem. It's a sport problem overall, you know. And I think that, you know, and I was in a meeting earlier this week and we were kind of talking about it, you know, as we were talking about, you know, the UFC pay-per-views and, you know, how much we have to spend to get them at the bar. And I was just kind of like, I said, the thing that it's just, unless it's Conor McGregor fighting or, you know, when Ronda was fighting or to a point, Jon Jones, Brock Lesnar, like you just, I don't feel there's these fights that get people excited. I mean, look, 221 was a fight card people were not excited for. I was looking ahead at UFC 222. And I don't know if you've looked ahead at this fight card, but it, to me, you know, it doesn't have that top fight that's going to get you all excited because, let's be honest about it, I mean, what, Cyborg opened up at, what, a 6-1 favorite? Wouldn't surprise me if she ultimately is a 10-1 favorite. I love Frankie Edgar, Brian Ortega. I don't think this is, you know, maybe this pay-per-view gets up to 300,000 buys, but just as, I mean, yeah, we report on this sport, but, you know, we're both also fight fans. As a fight fan, I really like the UFC 222 lineup.
What sticks out to you?
Well, it's the whole thing overall. I mean, you look at, obviously, Ortega and Edgar is a fight that really interests me. You know, can Brian Ortega take that next step in his career? You know, Sean O'Malley, how, you know, can the hype train continue? Next week on the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Andre Sukenthaw, and you're going to hear exactly kind of his thoughts on Sean O'Malley. You know, Strube Arlovski, I mean, nothing really gets me excited about that one. The FS1 prelims, I really love. Obviously, we have the UFC debut of Mackenzie Dern. Dariush Green should be a good fight. Dotson Munoz, which, of course, is supposed to happen earlier this month, I like as well. Dalloway Lombard, and not really a fan of that one. Pyle Otto, you know, with Mike Pyle, you know, you kind of wonder with him. Caraway and Cody Stamann, that's a bantamweight matchup I really like. And speaking of Cody Stamann, he'll be on this podcast next week.
Two questions. One, Katzingano's fight is still on this card, right?
Yes.
Okay. Two, you think Brian Caraway will ever fight Johnny Nunez?
I don't see that happen. It was funny. I'll tell you just a little teaser for my interview. I asked Cody because I'm the producer of the Valor Hour, and he was on their podcast a couple weeks ago. And he had said one of his major concerns about taking this fight was actually if Brian Caraway will show up on fight night. And I asked him a follow-up question. I said, hey, are you still concerned? He's like, you know what? He goes, if he falls out, I'm confident the UFC is going to find me a replacement opponent. He goes, the only bad thing is it's not going to be a top 10 guy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that kind of sucks because you can fall into the fantasy of like, oh my God, I have a guy who's like a legit name, legit fighter in the division of Brian Caraway, and you can kind of pull yourself way up. So that's the one downside is like you're guaranteed the fight. But yeah, there have been quite a few pullouts from Caraway on UFC cards, and I get it. But I just think, man, if you're a fighter, you can't let that get to you. And I'm pretty sure it doesn't get to Cody at all. It's just probably just something he talks about a little bit. But you just can't be thinking about it because, honestly, it's so random. And it could very well have just happened to you, man. It's not like these guys like – you know, it could happen to anybody in terms of pulling out of a fight. But, yeah, I will say just to close out on UFC 221, I felt like there was a lot of positives when it comes to guys' futures. Like, I thought there were multiple standouts outside of the main event and co-main event for this card. You mentioned them, man. But I just thought – Alexander Volkanovski just looked tremendous, just destroying Jeremy Kennedy on the ground. And I thought Jake Matthews took a big step up, and Tuivasa and Tyson Pedro could very well be stars in Australia. Israel Nsanye, who, again, we'll make sure to get his name right, but he's so exciting. And the weirdest thing in the world is, like, Juicier Formiga, like, opening up the TV prelims may have put himself in line for a flyweight. That is the weirdest, the fight placement of a future flyweight champion contender, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, he puts himself in great position. By the way, going back to a quick mention on Brian Caraway, his last fight, May 29th, 2016, that was UFC Fight Night 88, headlined by Thomas Almeida and Colby Garbrandt. Since then, he pulled out of UFC Fight Night 103, was supposed to take on Jimmy Rivera. That was back in January of last year, and then was also supposed to fight in December of last year against Luke Sanders. So it has been a long time. And of course, we'll get into UFC 222 once that fight card does get closer. But coming up this weekend on Friday, we have Bellator 194. On Sunday, we have UFC Fight Night 126. And first off, we want to talk about the Bellator fight card. Of course, going to be headlined by the second fight in the Bellator Grand Prix Tournament, which will be Roy Nelson taking on Matt Mitrione. And, of course, this is a rematch. The two of these guys did fight in the UFC. And I did find it very interesting that Matt Mitrione, this week, he was on Luke Thomas's SiriusXM show. And he mentioned that he really doesn't view this as a rematch. And the reason that he didn't view this one as a rematch was just simply because, you know, the first fight happened so long ago. It was, 6 years ago the first fight happened. And the fact of, you know, he's just totally a different guy. But, you know, the one thing I want to mention about this tournament, and when you pull up, you know, the bracket in this tournament, I think you can make a realistic case. If you are going to seed this tournament 1-8, number one is fighting number two in the opening round.
Really?
Okay.
You would put Roy Nelson number two?
Who would you put number two? I would say
the heavyweight champion.
Fedor would probably be my number two if it wasn't Roy Nelson.
So you wouldn't put Ryan Bader at number two?
No, he's a light. At the end of the day, he's a light heavy.
You don't think Ryan Bader is going to win this tournament?
It would shock me if the win. It would not shock me if the winner of Bader Mo, you know, gets into this tournament. And which I also think that, you know, I don't feel a lot of sense of buzz for this heavyweight tournament, and I think primarily is because of three of the eight guys in this tournament are really 205ers.
I guess, man, you see, me and you have different outlooks on this tournament, big time, like. You're probably right. Like, weight classes matter. The size is huge. I don't feel great about King Mo in this tournament, but I think the technique advantage Ryan Bader has over everyone in this tournament is pretty big. Like, it's a pretty steep difference in just skill set, what they bring to the table inside the cage. I could be totally wrong here. And we're not going to know if I'm right or wrong until, like, the semifinals.
I would love to know. I am sure Rich Chow has seeded this thing somewhere in his office, somewhere on his computer. I would love to know how he seeded this tournament, because clearly this tournament is not done by seeds. You know, I
mean, true, man.
You look at Fedor Frank Mir. I feel like the Fedor Mir fight was more made just to make sure it actually happened.
Well, I think Frank Mir has to be the eighth seed.
No.
You wouldn't put Frank Mir. Who would you put at the eighth seed?
Chael Sonnen.
Oh, that's a good point. I guess you're probably – I would put Frank Mir at the eighth seed just because there are so many question marks about Frank Mir.
Look, so many.
There's like 100 question marks.
No, there's obviously he hasn't fought in 2+ years. I mean, I think the thing about that Fedor Mir fight is, just as a old school fight fan, I would love to see that fight go to the ground.
That fight should start on the ground, and they shouldn't be allowed to strike. I would be into that. I think that would be the least sad possible situation there, and that would be exciting. I don't think that's going to happen, though, man. Like, I really feel like that's just going to play out where they're kind of tentative on the feet and just someone gets dropped early. But, I mean, those two fighters, especially in their prime, showcase such swift grappling games that I just think that would be fascinating. And it's a fight that would have been phenomenal, like, in 2007 or 2008, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but it's 2018. I mean, look, it would not shock me if by the time we get to the final, whenever that final would take place, who knows, that may not be till 2019. It would not shock me if ultimately the final of this tournament is a rematch between Mitrione and Fedor.
Man, that would shock me. That really would. Just because I don't know. Shock is a strong word. I will say that.
Surprise?
Surprise, just because, like, I remember, man, watching – to me, the fight that really aged Fedor for me was the Fabio Maldonado fight where he actually, like, won.
Awful.
Where he won that fight. Yeah. And when I watched that fight, he looked so old. I think just the idea of Fedor piecing together two wins over Frank Mir and then someone – there's no bracket, right?
Well, there is.
Is there a bracket?
There is a bracket in this tournament.
So he's gonna. He's gonna take on Rampage. I mean, Chael Sonnen. Fedor's gonna take on Chael.
Yeah, the winner of Fedor and Mir will take on the winner of will take on Chael Sonnen, and then of course the winner of Mitrione Nelson takes on the winner of Bader Mo.
Okay, I say, well, that's not the craziest map then. The idea that Fedor could beat both Mir and Chael Sonnen, that sounds easier than saying Fedor has to beat two top heavyweights to make it to the finals. I mean, he's definitely the favorite here. But I will say that with all that being said, Matt Mitrione among the heavyweights is the clear, clear favorite in this tournament. And I will say, just to refute one of his points in the Lou Thomas podcast, there is no way he wouldn't call this a rematch if he won the first fight.
I think one of the things that was also kind of interesting to hear him talk about it, and really I think it goes to the Fight IQ where he was saying, look, I'm not going to sit here and fight Roy Nelson in a phone book. You know, it's like, look, that means I'm not using my athleticism. I'm not using my, you know, my style to get me. I mean, that's going to be kind of, you know, can Roy, you know, look, Roy Nelson's, you know, as he has aged on, we have seen how he has evolved as a fighter. I mean, I think, you know, if Roy's going to win this fight, to me, it's him closing that distance, kind of, you know, making this kind of a clinch fest against the fence, gets a leg trip and uses his jiu-jitsu and strikes on the ground. But, you know, look, I've said, you know, from the start, Matt Mitrione is my pick to win this tournament. I think he's got it. I mean, look, the winner of Fedor Mir, do they have an easier path to the final? No question. I just wonder, by the time we get to Friday night, will there be excitement for this fight?
Man, I don't – I hope so. I really do, because I really do want Bellator to succeed. And again, in 2018, this is a point I've stressed, really. I do feel like this heavyweight tournament is, like, super important. Like, this is – like, we have seen Bellator pack it in with events where they're just saying, we know no one cares about this card. We're going to make some money in Italy, you know. But this is them trying, I think. And if they try and they fail – promoting these fights, that is a big red flag. So I hope people care. I think of the four matchups, this one is the third strongest when it comes to name value. I think the Chael Rampage and Fedor Mir are top two, and you could throw Bader King Mo either three or four. I think that's up for debate. So this isn't a top two quarterfinal matchup in terms of name value. And I kind of think that's how they set up the bracket, really, is they identified skill level and name value, and they have one bracket that's all name value, one bracket that's all skill level, one side of the bracket. And the more you tell me, it's like, I feel like when they laid out the bracket, they just said, what's the best way we can get Fedor to the final? And that's how they laid it out. But Mitrione, man, he's going to have a tough road, But in this one, I do think he's going to be successful. I like how you labeled it, man. I think distance is his friend here. Distance will allow him to generate it will allow him not to get tapped out for one, but it will just allow him to straight up land sharp combinations on the feet and just picking and moving around. And you got to consistently kind of change your platform of where you're striking to where you can continue to unload your offense. And I think it's a matter of time if Mitrione is able to consistently do that, that he will just put Roy Nelson away or at least win two rounds and get the decision. So I feel pretty confident about Matt Mitrione winning, but Roy Nelson is just an ageless wonder, a fighter who seemed like he stopped aging at the age of 43, 15 years ago. Like he's just been the same age with the same body and the same dangerous set of hands and garage jiu-jitsu game. So he's an underdog who has thrived in that spot time and again. But I do think Meathead will win and put himself in a tough spot because, again, I am all in on Ryan Bader in this tournament. That is my pick.
Co-main event on Friday night will be a lightweight rematch, Derek Campos versus Patricky Pitbull. The first matchup took place back in 2014. Patricky got the victory on that night by TKO. Of course, that was in a lightweight tournament matchup. And, I think that the winner of this matchup will ultimately be fighting the winner of Chandler and Brent Primus, which, of course, is going to be April the 13th. Fight card also see the return of Liam McGeary, of course, been out since last year due to an injury. Was supposed to fight back in October. That one did not happen. He's going to be taking on Vadim Nemkov. I did have a chance to catch up with Liam McGeary. Going to let you hear that conversation when we come back. We're going to talk about the rest of the Bellator 194 card. Liam, I appreciate time. Of course, unfortunately, you had to pull out of that fight back in October due to the thumb injury. You had to go through a little bit of recovery there. I mean, how would you describe the last 5 or 6 months of your career? Is frustrating a word that you would say?
Frustrating, up and down, annoying. Just shite as well, you know? There's a whole load of words I could use in there just to throw out there. But yeah, it didn't go to plan. Let's just say that.
Was there ever a moment where, like, what did you do to make sure you weren't getting down too much on yourself and understanding, like, look, I'm going to get better, but it sucks now, but there's better things to come?
Well, when I was injured? Yes. Or when I lost?
When you were injured.
Oh, you know what, man? I just let life... I let life catch up with me, and I let life. I just started acting my age a bit, you know. And I'm 35, so I had a lot of things to which I'd put away or put off, and I've been selfish for a long time. So I just let that crack on and just see where that took me.
Was that actually the first time you had? Was that the first time you actually had to pull out of a fight due to injury?
Yeah, I've never pulled out of a fight before in my life. I even asked the doctor if he could just fix it so I can get my hand in my glove. I was like, I just use my left hand. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't want to pull out this fight. I don't like pulling out fights, you know. I mean, the guys trained. Plus, Christmas was coming up as well, you know. So it was an expensive time of the year. So money would have been nice. So it was a whole load of things. So.
I was watching an interview you did, and you talked about the fact of, you know, you know wrestling is what you had to improve on. And I know you train with guys like Corey Anderson and David Branch. How has their impact been on your wrestling game? And is there anything that they have really said to you that just has really stuck out over the past couple of months?
I mean, yeah, training with these guys, these boys are monsters, and they've definitely helped me along my career. I mean, Dave Branch has been side by side with me for the last 6 years, you know, 5 years. So he's been a massive help. I was just literally talking to Corey today, you know, and it's like we've been training together now 4 years since he did the Ultimate Fighter. But I mean, I started working with a guy called Alex. Now I have no idea how you pronounce his surname. I just know it's Alex C. That's the only thing correct. Or I don't know. No, I can't even pronounce it. But I started working with him shortly after May, so maybe June, around about June, July time, I started working with this dude. And, man, it, changed my whole outlook on wrestling and changed my whole look, changed my game with wrestling, you know, and it complemented all the other aspects of my game. So that's why I was so looking forward to putting on a show in October, because I knew the level where I'd got to, and I knew what I was going to do, and I knew exactly what you was all going to be in for, you know. And everybody likes blood, everyone likes carnage, everyone likes a violent fight, and that's exactly what I was going to do, you know. And it just so happened I bust that thumb 2 weeks before, so I was annoyed, I was angry, I was pissed off, so yeah, disappointed.
The fight here against Vadim, were you even familiar with him when you got this fight offer?
I was, yeah. I've heard of him. I've seen him about before. Well, I've seen some fights with him. I see he dispatched that Philippe Lins in a very short time. So yeah, I mean, I knew of him, and then on social media, a few people were like, "This Liam McGeary against Demkov would be a good fight." So I obviously started checking into him, you know, because I knew one day it would come around.
What is the biggest challenge he's going to offer you on Friday night?
I think the question should be, what's the biggest challenge I'm going to offer him? You know, it's, I'm just concentrating on what I'm doing, mate. You know, he does what he does and I do what I do. And that's it.
Has there been a time in your career where you worried too much about what your opponent was going to attempt to do to you?
Yeah, and I lost. So that's why I stopped doing it.
Now,
look at the fight I fought against Brett McDermott, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't even know who I was fighting against. I had four different opponents in that fight, and I managed to do what I do. Then I started worrying about Lina Vassell and his wrestling takedown downs, and then what happens? He takes me down. The other guy, fucking Davis, I worried about his takedowns. Oh, you need to watch this. He does this, he does that, he does this. He did it, you know, and it's like I was worried about it, and he went and did it. So, you know what, man, I'm just going back to doing what I do. When I fight, when I got no care in the world, then that's when I'm the most dangerous. And when I'm angry, I'm even fucking worse. So,
Mohegan Sun is a very familiar venue for you. You've had some great moments in your career in that venue, winning the title there. Are you a superstitious guy at all? And do you keep the same routine, the fact that you've now fought there a couple times?
Nah, man. A cage is a cage to me. It still was only one dude across the cage trying to take my head off. I just want to take his head off first. Don't matter where it is, mate. I guess, I mean, like with the superstition. No, I'm not really superstitious, no.
You know, I was talking to Aaron Pico a little while ago, and he said on fight day, you know, he won't step on a red line, no matter what. That's what there's nothing that you subconsciously may do on fight day, or maybe when you walk into the gym, there's something that you just naturally just don't do.
No, nothing. Not gonna think of.
You are obviously one of the best light heavyweights in Bellator, but the division's kind of on hold at this point with Ryan fighting in the heavyweight tournament. Of course, he's taking on King Mo. Has Bellator said anything to you about, you know, kind of what the plan is for the heavyweight for the light heavyweight division, and particularly with a win here, what that does for you?
Nope. And I didn't even ask the question. Like I say, man, I take care of my business. My business is Vadim Nemkov. And once I take care of my business, I'll go on to the next thing. With Brian Bader being caught up in that tournament, sound. Gives me time to fight the other dudes, you know. So he's not going to be fighting. They're not going to be fighting him for the title. Once I start beating these guys, then I can go fight for the title when he's free.
I
look at it as a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you're everything is concerned about Vadim and going out there and getting the win after that. Anyone who follows you on social media knows that you and Lynn Vassell kind of were going back and forth a couple of weeks ago. Is that pretty, you know, is that the fight that you just kind of like, man, I want to get that one back?
Yeah, because he didn't get the real me. Sorry, I got mouthful of food. He didn't get the real me. That wasn't a true fight. But listen. Like I say, man, I've got Vadim Nemkov on my mind. I don't care about Linton anymore. You know, I worry about Linton. I mean, like, he's my friend, but
yeah,
I'll worry about that when the time comes.
How do you see the victory coming in this matchup?
It'll happen how it happens. It'll happen when it happens. I just see me being violent to him. You know, I just see it being an entertaining fight for the fans, and which they deserve. after the piss poor performance I put on the last one, me pulling out in October for the injury, I feel that maybe I owe the fans an explosive fight. What I like to bring. So that's what I got ready for.
And Daniel, there was my conversation with Liam McGeary, and I do kind of feel like, just because of the fact that we haven't seen Liam since May of last year, he's kind of become a little bit of a forgotten guy in this division. I also kind of feel with Bader and Mo in this tournament, I do feel like I kind of, and let me just get your thoughts on this. I feel like has light heavyweight kind of in a way just like become the forgotten division, where like Bellator's just hit pause on the division?
I think pretty much, but I mean, you do have fights going on, and look, there will not be a light heavyweight championship fight in 2018, right? Like, there probably won't be one. So
unless Bader Mo's in May. I mean, let's say Mo wins that fight. Uh-huh. Bader could realistically defend the title, say, October.
That's true. If Bader does lose, his next fight is a light heavyweight championship fight.
Yeah, but if he beats Mo in the opening round, guarantee that title's not getting defended in 2018.
Yeah, and the thing is, this division can afford that to happen because it is, I mean, for one, a lot of the names that are skill level close to the top have kind of already been in a position to have an opportunity, whether it be challenged for the title or fought a number of contenders fight and they failed. So a lot of the names almost need a year to rehabilitate their careers and get sharper and hotter. And I think it's not a complete tragedy where if this had taken place in, you know, look at how jam-packed lightweight is with Primus and Chandler and then a clear-cut number one contender fighting Campos Patrycki here. I think if that title was just put on ice for a year, it would be much more of a story than a light heavyweight in Bellator, especially since you have another light heavyweight in the tournament or two other ones. The thing about Liam McGeary that really shocked me was looking at the betting odds for this fight against Vadim Nemkov, where he is among main card fighters, this is the closest fight according to Five Times, which is not something I would have expected. But the more you look into Nemkov and, well, the way he entered Bellator knocking out Philippe Lienz, this is almost like he almost comes across like a Russian cyborg that has entered Bellator cleaning up all of the failed Bellator light heavyweight projects. So the betting odds is the thing that stuck out to me the most. It is how close this one is.
I just pull up the betting odds. I am fairly shocked that Anna Hulatin is a 3-1 underdog.
Yeah. That speaks more to Heather Hardy.
I just, and people are going to hear my conversation with Anna Hulatin here coming up. I think that, you know, look, the fact is Anna has had more MMA fights. This is going to be her sixth MMA fight. This is only the third fight for Heather Hardy. I think the question I have about Heather Hardy going forward is she more than just a boxer? How does she incorporate her kicks? Can she incorporate takedowns? When I look at Anna Hulatin, I see a fighter that she's been working on everything. I am shocked, and I don't know how much of that is simply maybe because of the promotional push that's out there in Heather Hardy, but Anna Hulatin being a 3-1 underdog is shocking to me.
Well, look, when Heather Hardy and Anna Hulatin have fought in MMA, and when we've seen them in Bellator, or in one fighting championship, the one thing they have not done is performed at a great level. They have been disappointments. And whether or not you're a part of the Heather Hardy hype train or you believe Hulatin has really put it together here, it is kind of outrageous for either of these two to be such a massive favorite when you look at the fact that we are talking about, on one side, a fighter who is 2-3, and on the other side, a fighter in Heather Hardy who's 1-1. So I get what you're saying. And I completely agree. I just don't know how you can get so gung-ho about one of these two fights. I think it's going to be a really solid fight. But this fight, to me, is two fighters that I think – and Scott Coker really wanted to make into a star. And they both kind of failed upon being thrust in the spotlight initially.
And of course, the thing about this fight is that this is part one of part two. Part two is going to be a boxing matchup. Both of their boxing promoters are going to be there on Friday night. And I'm going to let you hear my conversation right now with Anna Hulatin as we talked about this matchup and talked about other thing and other topics related to combat sports. Anna, I appreciate you coming on the podcast. Of course, you've got this fight here coming up on Friday night on the Paramount Network. Bellator 194, a part of the main card. Before we get into the actual fight, I want to get your thought. I had your coach, Angelo Reyes, on the podcast last week to talk a lot about what happened at the UFC event with Valentin Shevchenko. And, you know, I got his opinion from a coach's perspective. And I think you bring a very interesting perspective being a boxer, but also now a martial artist as well. And there's all this talk about should the towel been thrown in, should the referee have stopped the fight. From a fighter's perspective, do you even have that conversation with your coaches about, you know, if there does become a situation where the towel needs to get thrown in, of what your opinion of that is?
Yeah, I think it all depends on your upbringing and how your team works. From what I've been taught is, you know, the fighter, they're supposed to do one thing, and that's the fight. The attitude that you're supposed to have, and you want to make sure that your camp, your team brings out a phenomenal camp where you just want to get into the arena and you're just willing to die in the ring or in the cage. So with that said, you only have one thing to focus on, and that's the fight. It's the corner's job to stop the fight, throw in a towel. I've seen Freddie do that many times with some of his fighters where he felt like they were in really big trouble and the referee wasn't about to stop it or anything like that. And so I think a lot of it, you know, it's a little tough for I guess anyone to decide, especially if they don't communicate with that. But I'm just lucky enough to have my corner and my team, you know, just kind of talk about the whole dynamics of how the combat sport works, because, you know, when you go in there, you got to protect yourself at all times. Mm-hmm. You can't always rely on the referees, you know, the judges and things like that. You just have to know and surround yourself with the proper camp to know that they're in there for your best interest. So I hope that answers your question. Like, I know there's a lot of controversy behind that one. And, you know, it's an interesting one, especially with how Mario Yamasaki was able to, you know, respond to it. And I'm like, wow, you know, I personally have not seen the fight, mainly because I've been so focused on my fight. Yeah. But I've been hearing it's just been the same down the line. Everyone kept saying that fight should have been stopped early, you know. So
yeah, I mean, I think for me, and you know, and after I was over, I said, you know, I want to hear from a coach's perspective, get their perspective on it, because in MMA it is kind of we rarely ever see a towel get thrown in. It's not in the unified rules, but every time I've talked to an executive director or a referee about it, they all say if a corner throws in a towel, I'm going to honor that towel. I'm not going to say, oh no, it's not the unified rules. So for me, it's interesting to hear a fighter kind of break it down. I mean, for me, as I was sitting on my couch watching it, in my mind, one of the things I tweeted this, I go, is the corner going to stop the fight? And B, it was rough to watch, because it was so one-sided, dominating, and you know, you would have hoped that Mario would have, you know, I don't think the referee's job is to let a fighter be a warrior. They're in there to protect him, and I think that I can see if that's a coach's mindset. I just don't see that being a referee's mindset.
Yeah, I think, you know, all of this is relevant, and I'm just glad people are actually talking about it, just so it can just continue on and educating the audience and having everyone else within the industry on their toes when it comes to safety for the fighters, and just being a lot more aware, maybe having more definition in the rule set. And again, you know, MMA, for as phenomenal of a sport that it is still fairly young.
Yeah.
You know, it's barely been around for 30 years. And versus, like, if I were to talk about boxing, which has a very long, rich history, the evolution of it, where you just have a fight where there used to be no rounds, they don't stop until one actually is put out, to where it's very specific. You have a 12-round title fight. There's no no three knockdown rules and things like that. You know, it's just everything is just so specific. Like there are pages and pages and pages on the rule books in terms of like what needs to be done on everyone's end in order for a fight to happen in a very professional way. So if anything, you know, despite the outcome of it and how everyone feels about it, again, I didn't watch it, but what I do love is how this is going to continue on with growing the sport, growing the awareness, and just having it become a little bit more defined as to what people should expect when they get into the cage.
When I knew I was going to have you on the podcast, one of the things that I wanted to bring up to you is about, and I know you've talked about this in multiple interviews about how boxing and MMA, they are two different sports. Yes, they're both combat sports, but they're very different. For you, in terms of an MMA matchup, would you rather it be in a ring as opposed to a cage?
That, you know, that's an interesting question for me to answer right now, because being able to have the experience of, you know, fighting in the cage and then going back into the ring and then back into the cage and then back into the ring, I don't think with any fighters that's out there right now currently who is able to do both sports are doing that right now. And so because of the infancy stages of MMA, it's kind of, it's just untapped territory. So for you to ask me that at this point in my career, I actually still, you know, I love both, but obviously because I'm getting ready for the MMA match, I'm at a point where I'm feeling that comfortability just being into the cage. Whenever I get into a sparring session and preparing for a fight, I'm used to the 5-minute mark and just looking, just going over to my corner only twice within the 15-minute period. Versus when I go for a title fight, I get, you know, I do the allotted round, and then I'll see my corner after every round, whether it's 6 rounds, 8 rounds, 10 rounds, 12 rounds, etc. So the dynamic of all of it is very different, but just being able to stay and go back and forth with the two sports, it's nice to, you know, see the differences and get comfortable with the differences and, you know, just kind of go from there. But for right now, you know, I love both. From what I'm understanding right now is that MMA is exactly like boxing. Where in boxing, you're always lobbying for position. You have to know your awareness of where you are in the beginning, middle, and at the end of the fight. It's just that in MMA, you're playing the same game, except there's a lot more other pieces on the chessboard. So it's a brilliant, brilliant sport. And I feel like at the highest level, you know, if you have someone who's technically sound, someone who knows what they're doing, someone who's a veteran, you know, big shout out to someone like a Chael Sonnen, for instance. You know, I got to pick his brain a little bit about MMA, you know, his thoughts on it and what he's able to understand through his entire career. And it's phenomenal. It just talk about mastery, and he's able to just articulate it verbally, which is not common for me in the boxing gym. In the boxing gym, it's a little bit more territorial. You can't just go up to a fighter, especially a champion, and ask them, so what are your thoughts on this fight and this fight and this fight? They're going to be very guarded with what they have. Versus in MMA, people are a lot more intellectual. And they can actually verbally articulate it. And I think that's what I love so much about the martial art aspect of it, is you're always having the oral teachings of passing down the techniques and the lineage and, you know, everything else that comes right behind in order for you to build the next generation. So, you know, for me, I love both. I love fighting. Some of my earliest memories was watching a Bruce Lee movie in front of the TV. And just understanding, you know, just being able to see that and just connect with that at such a young age, you know, it's something that obviously affected me and became a career of mine. So right now I can't choose one or the other, Jason. It's really tough.
Yeah. Now, when you signed with Bellator, when Heather signed at Bellator, I was one of the people, and I'm not sure if we brought this up the last time we talked, and I said this was, I always thought that this was the matchup that Bellator was going to build up to. And obviously this matchup came a lot sooner than I think a lot of people thought it would happen. But while boxing and MMA can be different on fight night, on Friday night, is this simply going to be a boxing match in an MMA cage with 4-ounce gloves?
Oh, I guess we're going to have to tune in and wait and see. And that's what I love so much about MMA, is that there's so many ways to win, so many ways to lose, and you really don't know what you're going to get. And the way that I'm preparing for this is, you know, it's it's a fight at a very high magnitude, but I also understand the culture of it. You got to be prepared to fight whoever that night, because you just don't know if you are going to have a fight. Freddie Roach would always tell me, Anna, you will never know you'll have a fight until you actually step into the ring and you hear the first bell. Because whether you're destined to fight that person and it was scheduled, or they may end up falling off because of an injury, whatever, you still need to be prepared. So, you know, all I can say on my part is I'm going to put out a hell of a fight. And, you know, I feel like I've come to a much cleaner fighter, a lot more aggressive, a lot more action-packed. Big shout out for Bellator for just giving me the activity. Before my last fight, I was on a 2-year layoff from the cage. Mm-hmm. And even from my last MMA fight before the last one, so I'm talking about 2 years ago, I had a layoff a year before that. So just to even get this activity where I'm having fights back to back within a few months, it's made a change of difference. So I'm excited with what I've been working on, what my team has come up with, and how my body has been moving around. I think it's a dream for all fighters where they can just get into the gym and actually know that they're going to have a fight date set for them to perform their skills.
As this fight has built up, has there been anything that has said, whether it's from Heather or camp, fans, whoever it may be, the media, that has just bugged you?
That's a great question. Definitely a lot, in my opinion, a lot of social issues, in a sense where a lot of people just really don't know me in general, where I've been in the sport, in the fight game I've dedicated over 10 years of my life in the professional field. And I've fought all over the world, have won 3 world titles in boxing, have worked with some of the best, like Freddie Roach, watched Manny Pacquiao during his camps, you know, from one fight to the next, along with going down to Las Vegas, going over to the Mayweather gym, watching Floyd Mayweather train, and being able to have the opportunity to work with someone like a Roger Mayweather on my camp. And the thing is that for all of that to transpire, it didn't just happen because I'm a girl, because I'm Filipina. It happened because I worked really hard. And sometimes I feel like because I'm very approachable to talk, I like to be very professional. You know, that's just my demeanor. I'm a martial artist at heart. I was always taught to give out respect. Versus in the fight game, especially in boxing, you have to go out there and you have to earn the respect. Like, I know how to flip it on and off. And most times in the public face, I like to be a little bit more, just more outgoing, right? More approachable. And I think because of that, a lot of people just overlook a lot of the work that I have done. Now, in order for me to say that I work with a Freddie Roach, again, it's not something that was handed to me. I had to go out there and get it. Every fucking day that I was in the gym, I had to protect my spot. It wasn't like, okay, I arrive in the gym and everyone's giving me, you know, flowers and praises and all that. It was, you know, wolves upon wolves. And I happened to be one of the wolves who is a woman, who is a woman of color. And people would perceive me as a little wolf. And I had to always articulate myself. And I had to be a lot more vocal, a lot more vulgar and aggressive in order for me to just make my way. And, you know, even at the Mayweather gym, you know, a lot of the people, they recognize me because I've won titles, especially world titles, and especially coming from the wild card gym. And, you know, there's this little rivalry, especially at the time when I started going at the Mayweather gym. Roger Mayweather didn't just come up to me just because I was a woman, just because I happened to be an approachable Filipina. It just so happened that I would go in there every fucking day. I would do my work. And then on days of sparring, I would have 3 sparring partners, males, come in and they would rotate me as I was getting ready for title fights. And then after that, I would still do all my gym work after. And then at my most tiredest point, that's when Roger Mayweather would come up to me and say, hey, let me do some stuff with you. And he started working with me on that camp. So a lot of the shit that ended up happening was because of just pure hard work. And sometimes I feel like people, they just overlook it, mainly because they just judge a book by its cover. And I would say that's probably the biggest thing that has been so apparent, especially for this fight, the fight at this magnitude. And what gets me just really upset is how I've heard some people say that this fight didn't even happen because of me, when it happened because of me. Had I not been calling out Heather on our last fight, despite our what happened on our fight, we wouldn't be relevant, especially her coming off of a loss, getting her nose smashed in, 36 stitches, against someone who is a pro debuter. Now, what a lot of people don't even just give me the credit for was not my last fight, the fight that happened like 2 years ago, that layoff. My last fight with this other organization was against a K-1 world champion. Not a pro debuter, K-1 world champion. I came out of that just fine. And on top of that, I was working on my MMA craft. I was working heavily on wrestling. I took the girl against the cage. I actually took her down. I attempted and actually performed and executed takedowns. Yet a lot of people would overlook that. And then I get criticized for not using my hands enough. And I'm like, wait a minute. Do you guys understand that MMA and boxing is not the same? Obviously not, because Floyd Mayweather ends up fighting Conor McGregor, and about 90% of the entire world thought that Conor McGregor is going to go in there and just take out one of the best boxers we have in our era on his first fight. So you got to imagine, just being on my end, it's like a day in the life. You know, it's a constant battle. The easiest part for me, Jason, is just stepping into the arena and fighting. That, I love that. As intense and as gruesome and as violent as some people may see it, for me, I just feel free because I don't have to think about anything else. I can attach and connect myself with what my body just really love and appreciate. It's just everything else that comes out of it. It's just wow. It's a daily battle. So to answer your question, I would say it's that. A lot of people just overlooking a lot of my work. I mean, it's very disheartening, because I'm thinking, wow, you know, if this is how it is for me as a Filipina, you know, who has been in this craft for a very long time, yet people don't know about me. And some of the people in the media don't even want to talk about it. They don't want to highlight it. They don't even want to share my story for all the things that I've accomplished, like meeting the president of the Philippines, you know, just being able to work with someone like a Rodel Mayall for my training camps. He was my chief sparring partner. And for those who don't know who he is, look him up. He was a world champion in boxing, a knockout artist, and Freddie wanted me to go after that guy. That was my training. You know, I'm a real fighter. Yet because of my external experience, appearance, and how people look at me and how people perceive me, for whatever reason, it doesn't quote unquote count. And I'm like, you know what? The only thing I could do is bite my lip. In this industry, you have to have a thick skin, which is what I've been carrying with me for my entire career. And, you know, I just got to go out there and do my job. I was like, okay, if there's anything that you guys are going to be writing about, it's going to be writing about, you know, my performance, especially with how everything else transpired, because a lot of people aren't putting all the pieces together. And for anyone to make any development, and to just move on to the next level, you have to put in the work. You have to go through the ups and downs. And at the end of the day, you just don't quit. And so that's who I am. I'm a fighter. I go through adversity and I come right out of it. So hope that answers your question, Jason. Thanks for letting me, give me the board and let me say my piece, because I really feel like it's underlooked.
Something you mentioned there is something I do like to try to highlight with fighters, because I understand that for the, you know, a good amount of time, you necessarily can't control the message that ultimately goes out there in a ways of what you want fans to know about you. You know, because, I mean, there may be people who come up on Friday night. This may be the first time that they've ever seen you compete. Maybe they've seen your name in news stories. But for those people, like, what would you want them to know about you?
All I can say is I just want them to just tune in. And at the end of the fight, they need for everything that they're going to build my opponent as, and as, you know, for everything that they say how great she is and all that. After I win, they can't take that away from her. They can't say, oh, she wasn't that good. Oh, she's not this. She's not that. They have to give out the credit. So for me, we've been working really hard, just been really focused. And, you know, that's the only thing that's on my mind. Even though it's a dual fight where we fight in the cage and in the ring, I'm not even thinking about the ring. It's about this fight.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you can tell me if I'm wrong here. I get the sense of you kind of, you're walking this fight, feel like people are not showing you the respect you deserve for everything that you have accomplished in your combat sports career. Am I correct?
Yes, you could say that. Yes, please do.
I mean, I just, you know, just sitting here to listen to you, that's kind of like, I think there probably is a lot of people out there that are going to walk in this fight and go, oh, you know, the way Heather has been promoted, you know, they'll look at her as a favorite in this matchup. I mean, is that just simply added motivation just to basically shut those people up?
I think it would have been like extra added motivation if you were to ask me that, probably 5 years ago when I was a little younger.
Uh-huh.
For me, just being in this phase of my career, like I understand that aspect of the game. Like I know there's all these different things, but you just asked me a personal question in terms of like what bothers me most, because usually I'm like, you know, I'm very professional. So with that said, I'm thinking, you know, I'll take it like a grain of salt. It's exactly what it is. And the only thing that I can just really focus on is just my performance.
I did hear something you said about this fight that I just found very interesting, and you don't necessarily hear fighters talk about this a lot. You talk about the kicking aspect of this game and, you know, where you kind of, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but basically you felt that maybe Heather didn't quite understand that, especially in her last fight. As a martial artist, do you just simply view Heather as one-dimensional?
All I can say is what she showed from her last two fights, and she definitely went in with her strengths. She went in with boxing. So with that said, the boxing lines don't necessarily line up with the kicking lines. And, you know, as we saw on her last fight, it just showed. That's all I can really say for that one.
And of course, this is part one of what we believe is going to be two parts. The second part being boxing. We have to see how this fight plays out on Friday night. You know, how do both of you come out of this? Medical suspensions, whatnot. But is your hope that sometime in the second half of this year that the boxing matchup will take place?
Oh, I would love to, but I can't even think that far ahead. I mean, what I love is that this fight actually happened, and it's happening at the way it is. It's getting people excited. It's going to be the first of its kind. It's going to be a classical matchup. And obviously, in order for all of this to work, for it to help the future for combat sports, is having that rematch. So it needs to happen. Both of our promoters will be there. Mine, Alan Tremblay, he'll be there. Her promoter Lou DiBella will also be there, and then, you know, I think they'll just meet up after the fight, talk with Bellator about it, and see, you know, where we go from there. So, it's pretty exciting because we really won't know what's going to happen mm-hmm. until we fight. So everyone's tuned in February 16th. Mount Network watches on Bellator. Yeah.
I mean, we have seen how women's MMA has propelled itself, you know, going back to Gina Carano, most recently with Ronda Rousey, but we necessarily haven't seen that in boxing. Do you think that this could be the fight that kind of can propel, you know, women's boxing to go to another level? I mean, or is that just the kind of the hope that this is a fight that ultimately can get people to realize of that there's a lot of quality, you know, in boxers out there?
I think it can, but a lot of it greatly depends on the eyes and the minds of the female athletes in boxing, the promoters and the networks, and all of them kind of being on the same wavelength. Because in combat sports, Angela says it the best, it's almost like being a rock star. You got to build your name brand. You got to get people excited, and they have to come and watch your fights, watch you perform. Versus if you just want to go in there, you just want to compete, I'd say just go and, you know, stick with the amateurs. You don't have to worry about promoting your name and things like that. If you want activity and you just love it just for the hell of it, I'd say stay in the amateurs. But in terms of getting to professional fighting, you have to understand the business aspect of it. So it's definitely a full-time job. You have to get your road work in. You got to get your gym work in. And on top of that, too, you have to have a great team, a lot of direction. You have to know where you want to go and just always aligning yourself with their proper promotional company that will want you to do it. Like there's some other companies where you sign with them, you have to stay exclusive with them, and then you won't have any sponsorship opportunities, versus like with Bellator. And I think they're going to be the premier for MMA fighting, is that they will allow you to do whatever the fuck you want. If you're a fighter, you can go and box, you can go do MMA, you can do this, you can do that. Just so as long as it works out in the schedule. It's like, oh, you aligned yourself with certain companies. Great. Let's see if it works out with Viacom. All right, Viacom gave you the thumbs up for that. Go ahead. You want to pull in the $250,000, $350,000 that Bellator's not going to touch on top of your purse? Go right ahead. Oh, and then right after that, after your medical clearance, you can go ahead and do a boxing match. Oh, wow, your name branding is so high that for your first four-rounder as a boxer without an amateur career, you can already start out with $50,000, $100,000, depending on how good, how big your name, your name brand is. So, for women's boxing in the United States, there's a lot of opportunity. There's a lot of possibilities for it, but it's, we also have to remember too that boxing is a global sport. I earned a lot of my money, a significantly larger amount of money in being a boxing world champion, more so than my current Bellator contract. But what I love about Bellator is that they're giving me an opportunity to actually get more revenue with other means, with sponsorships and endorsements, and also being on TV, et cetera. But in boxing, there is a lot of money to be made, but you can't do it with a lack of awareness. You have to just educate yourself and know what the business models between the two sports, because just like in competing, they're different ball games. So I would say if anyone, again, is going into professional fighting, just know that you're also going to be an entrepreneur. And for any entrepreneur getting out into the capitalistic world, you got to have a plan. You have to yes. have a plan. So that's all, that's my two cents for that.
That is very true. Final thing on it, I appreciate the time. Of course, you know, we've mentioned about your coach, Angelo Reyes. You got any good stories on him?
Man, there is just tons. But if I were, the ones that's popping up in my head right now, you probably won't want me to mention it because they're just so funny, just so comical. But I'll tell you what, for anyone who actually get a chance to meet him, he's a ride or die kind of guy. Like if any fighter gets to work with him, you will feel that, you will know that. I mean, this guy, he was having a conversation with one of Frank's advisors, and in the car, they were talking about who is the greatest heavyweight MMA champion ever live. And, the other guy says Miocic, and Angel's like Frank Mir. And then when they asked Frank Mir who he thought was a great heavyweight champ right now, and he also said Miocic. And he has to go and compete with Angelo in terms of, like, Angelo's telling him he's the greatest. Like, you know what I mean? And so Angelo will just have nothing but pure love. He's like the Jiminy Cricket. He's like the Morpheus for any fighter. You know, you can take this road, you can take that road. Whatever you road you go, I'm going to ride and die with you. It's like, I'm with you all the way. And for me, it goes a long way, because every time I step into the cage or into the ring, man, it's fucking war. You know, at the end of the night, it's not like, you know, you go to a party and then you take your shower. If you end up taking a shower that night, you turn out regular, versus like on a night of a fight, you can be going to the hospital, staying there all night. You could be taking a shower and there's blood going down the drain. You might not be walking out the same. You know, it's a different vibe altogether. And it's nice to know that when you go out there on your shield, you got someone who has your back. Classic example, one of the ones that I love is when Floyd Mayweather fought Zab Judah. Have you seen that fight?
Yeah. I remember seeing that fight back in the day. Yeah.
Do you remember when on the 11th round, it's like the later rounds, I think Zab Judah came in with a low blow. And Floyd started, you know, taking a knee and stuff because he just got hit in his jock. And then Roger Mayweather just straight up came into the ring, and he was about to get down. He's about to throw down with Zab Judah. He didn't care about the commission. He didn't care about anything. He just knew that you just went out there and you were just fucking with my cousin, you know, or my nephew. So it's just, man, that's Angelo. You know, I'm just lucky, and I'm so thankful that there is someone like Angelo just in my life, because I'll tell you what, he's seen a lot of shit, and that's something that you cherish. It's something that you just can't, there's no price on that. You know, it's like a one in a gazillion thing to have that type of relationship with anyone. So
that's the type of people you want in your corner.
That's all I got to say about Angelo. Oh, for sure.
But, of course, everyone's going to be able to see your fight come on Friday night. Of course, it'll be on the Paramount Network, 9 p.m. Eastern Time from the Mohegan Sun. Of course, it's going to be headlined by Roy Nelson, taking on Matt Mitrione in the second matchup in the Bellator Heavyweight Grand Prix. Ana, as always, I appreciate time. And, of course, let all my listeners know where they can follow you out on social media.
Oh, yeah, just plug in my name. It's spelled A-N-A-J-U-L-A-T-O-N. And if you happen to be a part of the media and you're listening to this, please say it correctly. And I'm not going to name any names, so I thank you, Jason, for actually saying my name correctly. But I'm going to point out for everyone else who won't take the time to actually do the job that they're getting paid for. It's Hooligan. It's just pay out some respect. That's what you're paid to do.
And the advice I always give is go to YouTube and just watch a video of like a ring announcer saying it. And you just hope they're saying it right so you're learning it the right way.
Yeah, just a couple of seconds out of your day. A couple of seconds. It didn't take that long.
And Daniel, there was my conversation with Anna Hooligan. Look, as I said, for me personally, I'm just surprised of the betting lines. And if you really look at the history of Bellator women's fights, more times than not, the underdog does come in there win. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show that I believe that Chris Cyborg was a 6-1 favorite. I'm on bestfightodds.com. She's actually a 13-1 favorite at five dimes. At Sportsbook, she is 15-1 favorite, and we're still, 21, 25 days away from this fight. Holy cow.
This is insane to me. To me, the most interesting, for gambling, and it's not like public information, so you probably couldn't gamble on it, but the best thing I think to do, or the coolest thing to do, would be gambling on the buy rates for that pay-per-view. I think that would be awesome. That would be tough to predict, you know? You could do...
All right, over under, 275K.
Over. You know why? Because I learned my lesson on Cyborg.
I think if you set the number at 300K, I think you get a little, I think that's probably right around the number where it ends up at. But yeah, I would tell you, here's what I thought was very interesting, Daniel, in terms of buy rates. I put a Twitter poll out last Saturday about... are you going to be watching UFC 221? I put three options. I put yes, home or friend's house, yes, at a bar or restaurant, or no. Now, of course, I think it was like 60% was no, but I was surprised that there was a higher percentage on at home or a friend's house than at a bar or restaurant.
Wow. I would have assumed bar or restaurant.
That's what I thought. I thought bar and restaurant would be – I think bar and restaurant was only like 10% or something.
Well, to be fair, your followers are hardcore fans.
Yeah, no question.
Like that is the pool. I mean, it's kind of surprising so many people said no, honestly. But, yeah, I would assume
– I think it's just people saying, I'm not going to pay $65 for this pay-per-view when, it's just, what – And we said here on the podcast, it just how can you compare 221 to what you got at UFC 220 for the same price?
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was a bad week for the UFC, man. Again, we always try and keep it fairly balanced because you can get if you think too hard, it can be really sad. But it was just simply put, it was a rough outing for the UFC. I mean, they are in a funk. They are in a real funk when it comes to putting on shows that people care about. As simple as that. I mean, you look at the card in Austin, this week. There's very little buzz for it.
Oh, and I think it becomes this problem of when you have – I saw this line over the weekend that the UFC – I guess this goes back to September – of last year, they're in a run of 24 shows in 26 weeks.
That's insane.
I was like, I saw it and I was like, oh my God, it was one of the Wrestling Observer writers had tweeted it out. And then I started to think about it. I said, yeah, man,
What week are we at?
I think we're getting towards the tail end of this number, but I mean, there's an event every week at this point.
Yeah. Oh my God. That is so terrifying, Jason. That's half the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, half I mean, year, and that's
half the year we had half of the year, all but two of those weeks, 4 to 7 hours of our day was spent watching fighting. Isn't that on a weekend? That's the saddest thing ever.
But this is what I have found myself over the last, I would say, year, where I have found myself probably watching as many cards on DVR as I do live.
100%. I watch most TV cards the day after.
Now, I mean, now sometimes that could be like I've got something going on with work, and you know, I'd like to get, you know, 6-7 hours of sleep every night, or maybe it's a reason of like I'm just not going to sit at home, or you know, because I just don't like this fight card. You know, this fight card on Sunday does start. The main card will start at 9 p.m. Eastern time. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be some people who say, hey, I got to go to work the next morning. I'm not staying up till God knows the main event probably won't end until 12:30 at night, East Coast time.
It sucks, too, because, like, I think looking at that card, I mean, that to me is – that's worth staying up for. But it's like, man, if this was just a 10-fight card, or, you know, if this was just a 10-fight card, and you put this fight on at a more appropriate time, Donald Cerrone and Yancy Medeiros is going to reward those people that stick through it. But if you got work tomorrow and you're six fights into a card and you're six fights in, and what do you got? Brian Camozzi and Jeffrey Neal? You know, that's just not – I mean, that's a tough – I mean, how many fights are on this freaking card? Is it not 14 or 13?
13 or 14. But I mean, here's the thing. Like, you look at Donald Cerrone, I mean – he loses. This will be four in a row. He hasn't won since December 10th, 2016 against Matt Brown.
That's crazy to me because it just seemed very recently this was a fighter who was on an upward trajectory, and it's like I think it's real likely he does lose here. Yancy is – I think he's going to probably trade a Yancy Medeiros.
Yeah.
I think he's cowboy for a reason. He loves to be a part of firefights. And that may not be the greatest fight IQ this late in his career. I do wonder, like, if the losses change the way he approaches this fight and if he plays it a much more conservative style. Because I think if he looks to have a fight of the night, he very well will have a fight of the night. And that would likely come at the cost of, you know, getting his hand raised. And four losses in a row is just not something I would have expected out of Cowboy Cerrone this year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that I look at, you know, when I look at this fight card, you know, Cerrone Medeiros, great fight. That's a fight that interests me. You know, James Vick, Francisco Trinaldo is an important matchup at 155 pounds. After that, what gets you to the television set on Sunday night to watch it live?
I think Sage Northcutt, man. Sage Northcutt, baby. I'm all in on this kid, Sage Northcutt. I don't know if you've heard of him, but
I've heard rumblings of him. Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of crazy that Sage is fighting, and it's not a bigger deal. But you know, this could be one of those deals where, after a lot of failure, he turns it around and favorite against Tipo Goti. But yeah, point taken. This fight card very weak, very top heavy. I'm looking forward to Lewis and Tiber. I'm looking forward to the main event. But otherwise, if you're asking me which fight I'm most looking forward to, man, I mean, my answer, like, I don't have – there is not something that sticks out to me that I just cannot wait for. I think Trinaldo James Vick is probably going to be a really lackluster-type fight. That fight, to me, is the one that's the most interesting talent level outside of the top two. But there aren't a lot of great high-level prospects. I just think I don't know. I think Alex Morono may look really great against Josh Berkman. Like, that could be a highlight reel performance. But other than that, I mean, nothing really, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in this fight card did lose Jessica Aguilar, who's supposed to be on that fight card. Her opponent pulled out. It does not appear that she is going to get a short notice fight. UFC looking to either put her on the Orlando, potentially on the Orlando card, maybe potentially UFC 222. Actually, I got an email from Ticketmaster today. The UFC fight night card in Orlando, the Fox event. Now the first fight will start at 3:30 p.m. Eastern local time. I don't know if I'll make it there for the first fight. Just me.
You're gonna be there, bro. But you're gonna be so tired by the time the TV show starts.
The last time they were in Orlando, we walked into the venue like two fights before the main card started.
You're an Orlando power player. You are a true celebrity.
Power player.
Yeah, I hate all these freaking power players that show up to cards late, man. You spend all that money on a damn ticket, and you're showing up for the main card. You're not Snoop Dogg, Jason. You know? Get all your value, man.
No, I get that. I mean, it's, you know, as you know, once I get like the fight week, I'll look and see what are the fights I really want to see.
And it's going to be like three fights, probably.
I know we're driving over that day. So it ultimately depends on what time we get to Orlando and check into our hotel.
Okay, question.
And how quick the Uber gets to us.
Question. I don't know. Have you been to a UFC where it's on TV? And if so,
yes.
What happens for the live audience when they like are talking for 30 minutes on TV?
Oh, nothing.
Oh, that just sounds like the craps. That sounds awful. That's so bad. Can you imagine that? That's like such an awful idea for a live event to have 13 fights or 12 fights and those large gaps of happening.
I mean, that's like one of my biggest issues with kind of the UFC and FS1 is, you know, they're trying to fill up so many hours of airtime. And, you know, like, God, when you go back to the studio, I'm like, look, we're both in broadcasting. We understand why these things happen, but it's just... Is it content that is quality content for the viewer, or is it content just to fill up airtime?
I don't know. But look, they don't need to fill up all the airtime. They should just cut down on their airtime. Like,
well, it's like when I hear people who go podcasts, they say, oh, I do a hour-long podcast, an hour-and-a-half hour. I'm like, why do you set a time limit on how long your podcast is going to be? You know, go as long as the content's good. When the content's starting to wear down in the podcast.
Okay, look, here's the thing. Okay, I think when I'm watching these Winter Olympics that have just started, I will always stop the channel when there is a sport happening on the TV. But when they are doing like a panel or like, yeah, you know, somebody like an interview, unless it's with a marquee athlete, I'm changing the channel. Like, as a TV viewer, as someone who's not a hardcore fan of the Olympics or these sports, I will only stop watching if there is action on TV or a sport. And I just can't imagine a casual fan of sports stops the channel with Karen and Brian talking to whomever or stops the channel with – yeah, you know, what's it, Jake Lazer on the Bellator?
Yeah, I mean, here's all three things. Is it content that is great content, or is it just filler content? And I think more times than not, and I'd probably say 90% of the time, it's just filler content to fill up airtime.
Yeah, and it's just
I will tell you,
not necessary.
True story here. If I'm sitting at home watching like an FS1 event, there are times where I'll just plan my day and say, you know what, I was going to clean the house today, but oh, no, there's a UFC event on FS1 tonight. I know I'm going to have plenty of time between fights to clean the house.
Yeah, or I have time to do college homework. It's clear in between. You're going to, yeah. For, I mean, it allows you to do things. You know, I find myself getting distracted by Twitter, and I'm like, oh, my God, we're halfway through the first round of another fight. You know, I got, you know, and look, if you're going to have all this airtime, man, maybe they should do something different. Like, I don't know what that creative idea is. I don't know if it's like you just stick a camera on Aoiya Quinta at the bar next door and you just continue to cut to that of him yelling at people.
Or put some good features on fighters. You know, like, for instance, and here comes a little transition for you here. You know, do a video where you went to Albuquerque and you were with Joby Sanchez and talking about his return to the UFC and how he's a different fighter now. And by the way, speaking of Joby Sanchez, I did have a chance to talk to him about his return to the UFC. Joby, I appreciate the time. I was looking at your Instagram feed and there was a post you put up on December 31st where you said, "It's been real 2017. I've grown a lot this year, not only as a fighter, but as a man as well. I've accomplished a lot of goals this year, and I'm grateful to everyone that has helped me accomplish these goals. 2018 is going to be even better." How would you say you've grown as a fighter in 2017 coming into 2018?
As a fighter, I've just worked more on my foundation, my base. Went back to the drawing board. I've been working with Matt Finney, who's my boxing coach, and he's really helped build my helped build my foundation, and I feel a lot better there. I've been working with Harry St. Ledger, who's a former Olympian for judo, and he's an Olympic alternate, And yeah, it was the black belt in jiu-jitsu, college level wrestling. And another thing I've been working with is a mind coach. So just different things. Kind of after getting cut from the UFC, I reflected and I'm like, what do I need to do to get better and put the right people around me? And been working hard every day.
And they always say, I mean, you go into a fight, your mind's got to be in the right place. If not, you're not going to perform the way you want to. In terms of working with somebody on the psychology side of sports, was it something that you just kind of recognized, or was somebody around you said, hey, we think you should do this because we think this could, you know, really help you?
One of my teammates was working with him, and he highly recommended him. I was like, I'll give it a shot. So.
And, of course, you know, you got this matchup here. Another thing that you mentioned about your striking coach, you had posted a picture the other day where you said, always great knowledge and wise words. What are some of those wise words that have been said to you in this camp?
Wise words. I was talking more about life and great knowledge as far as fighting. His understanding of MMA is very, very good. As far as the wise words, he always has good advice. I can go to him for any problem, and he's very intelligent and can see from a high perspective. And I always trust his perspective. So nothing in particular of this camp, just always he's someone I can go to because I trust him.
And of course, this is your first fight since those wins on the Contender Series. And, you know, you mentioned you're a changed guy, how you evolved as a fighter. How would you say you are different now as opposed to the last time we saw you?
Just more improved. Nothing too different style-wise, just better, more improved. Good wrestling scrambles, good ground and pound, good stand-up.
When you get the fight offer against Roberto here, was he a familiar name? Were you aware of him, or did you have to kind of, you know, go look at to kind of see who he was?
No, I knew exactly who he was. He fought, being LFA former champ, he fought a friend of mine too, Jerome Rivera. In a good fight, I think Jerome can beat him 9 times out of 10, and Roberto just got the one. But so that was the first time I really saw him. And then, of course, I watched Joseph Morales and him fight on their debut. Joseph Morales, another guy, I'd been looking at. I was trying to fight him in GKO for his title. So watching that fight, I knew exactly who they both were, and. And so when they called me and asked me if I want to fight Roberto, I said, let's do it.
Has Jerome been a big big tool to use in preparations for this fight?
No, he has not. I haven't been able to train with him. We train at separate gyms. We're just friends, though. Small town, Albuquerque.
It's not something where maybe you pick up the phone and say, hey, you got any tips for me? Any tricks you saw?
He sent me his film, the film of their last fight, because it's not on the internet or anything. So, and he had it himself. So he sent that to me. Of course, we talk, stuff like that. He always gets, he knows, he believes in me. I think someone would. So.
In terms of Roberto as a fighter, what sticks out to you about him of the things that you know you're going to see in the fight? You know, he's going to throw a certain combination. What really sticks out to you about him?
His stand-up, he pressures forward, but is nothing super threatening as far as punches. He's pressuring forward to look for the takedown. And once he gets you down, that's what he really wants to do. He wants to implement his jiu-jitsu game. He's a brown belt in Gracie Baja jiu-jitsu. His ground and pound isn't super aggressive. He, again, just kind of uses it to set up his jiu-jitsu. Off his back, he has good hips, but nothing I haven't seen before. That's another thing. Like, I don't find him super threatening, and not with the guys, because of the guys that I train with. I train with Ray Borg, John Dodson, guys that are nowhere near the level as us.
In terms of you mentioning about his jiu-jitsu, is that where you think he's going to try to get the fight?
Yeah, I'm gonna catch him. I'm going to catch him right on the chin, and he's going to want to take him to the ground right away.
Seeing the face reaction there, it almost seems like as you have visualized the fight, you see the victory come by knockout.
What I see for sure is I am going to catch him on the chin. He's going to know right away that I don't want to be on the feet with this guy. And I will. He's going to go for the takedown. If I have to finish him with some ground and pound, I will.
You know, and obviously you're in this fight with four wins in a row here, last two being on the Contender Series. Have you even allowed yourself to kind of think about, you know, what's next after this matchup? Or is the mindset of all my worries are about February 18th and I'll worry about the future after that date?
I am going to try and fight three times this year, but I haven't looked past Roberto. My goal is three times this year, and then but first I must beat Roberto to see who's after that.
Besides having a goal of fighting three times this year, is there any other goals that you've set for yourself this year?
Hitting at least one bonus. So.
And of course, I know. Go ahead.
What?
No, go ahead.
I would say a knockout this fight, but.
And of course, we're going to have to tune in for UFC Fight Night 126 to see how your fight does ultimately go down. I know you're much more of a active on Instagram than Twitter, but how can people follow you?
You can find me on Twitter at Joby Sanchez and on Instagram, Joby1_Kenobi.
And there was my conversation with Joby Sanchez. We'll see how he does in his return to the UFC. Of course, coming off those wins in the Contender Series. Of course, most notably back in August, getting that win against JP Baez. Also got a win against Manny Pacquiao. He's won 4 in a row since exiting the UFC. So we'll see how well he does there on Sunday there in Austin, Texas. But Daniel, we want to wrap up this week's edition of the podcast talking about some of the latest news and notes and topics. One of the topics, this is actually a topic that you wanted to mention here, was which UFC fighter not ranked in the top 10 of their division has star power. And I will tell you, I went through the UFC roster and I came up with multiple names, and I'm just going to, I know we've got some of the same fighters here, but I'll give my complete list. Taiya Tuivasa, of course, we just saw this past week. Eric Anders, who just headlined the UFC card. Mike Perry, Dom Reyes, Akeem Dawodu, Rob Font, and if she ultimately ever does end up fighting in the UFC, Megan Anderson.
Counter to Anderson would be if she ever fights, which she probably will, Mackenzie Dern. As far as female fighters, yeah, I feel like it's cheating if I just say Adrian's aunt, right? But if I'll say her and say Northcutt, I'm just going to go double dip on the cheating. Irene Adanya, when he comes back from Korea, he may get another fight before he leaves, but Duho Choi, I think, could be revitalized and he could be interesting. Tatiana Suarez, I think Gokhan Saki at light heavyweight could be a Terminator type star. And I'm surprised this guy actually isn't even ranked. I'm going to double check one last time. Mirpik Taisimov, I think.
I don't think he is ranked.
He has really done well for himself, and that kind of speaks to the lightweight is just an absurd division. It really is. But at 29 years old, the Russian has won five straight fights in the UFC, and most of them actually, yeah, those five straight fights all by knockout. I think Taisimov talent levels there. I think we got a nice list. And here's something I was thinking of. Do you think we will see WWE wrestlers who were MMA fighters return to the cage, and will they be bigger stars? Like, do you think Shayna Baszler will return to the UFC one day and fight again? Or do you think Matt Riddle will return to the UFC and fight again? And do you think they will actually be names when they return, if they return?
I say no. I think your best chance is Brock Lesnar. I think there's a good chance you see Brock within the next year have a UFC fight.
I think so too.
I think I saw something that his WWE deal expires after WrestleMania.
Yeah, it expires in April, and he's been champion the entire year. So I think he's probably tired of wrestling. Like, it's not like he wrestles that much. Like, he wrestles like once a month at the most, really. So yeah, I think he's probably going to come back. And it seems like he's the type of guy who, it's like a guy who has three wives, you know. Like, but he only spends time with them. Like, there's a lot of off time where Actually, that's a bad example. Okay. It's like somebody who, like, okay, it's like a father with three families, right? Where, like, you spend time with one of your three families, and then since you're gone, the other two families long for you to be father again. And so that's kind of the deal, is the UFC longs for Brock Lesnar. And once he gets popped for steroids, we will want him out of our sport. But anyways, I think Brock Lesnar will come back too.
Yeah, I do. You know, and we're going to get into USADA here momentarily. Do want to mention, you know, one of the things that I guess the journalistic integrity in me absolutely despises is clickbait stories. And I saw a story on Monday from MMAmania.com, and I truly hope, and I'm sure by the time, since this writer probably has been ridiculed 1,000 times, where he does a story based on an Instagram post of Conor McGregor being in Amsterdam, and there's a bunch of weed around, and basically saying how this, you know, the story was essentially like, oh, this should be a little tip to USADA. I'm like, apparently the writer does not know that marijuana is only banned in competition, and out of competition, it's not a banned substance. I just saw the article I sent to you. All that was pure clickbait. If that was, you know, some, you know, low-ranked 155-pound fighter in the UFC, that article's not even written. That was a straight-up clickbait story.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, like, the article's titled, USADA might be interested in this photo of Conor McGregor next to what, a giant tub of weed. It's like, come on, bro, such a narc. But yeah, it's such a stupid article, and it is very much clickbait. And by God, it has worked, because this article has like 224 comments. Like,
Jesus. Worked, but it's like, if you're gonna write that story, you really should know, because clearly the writer of the story has no clue that marijuana is only banned in competition.
Yeah. Yeah. As it should. Because, like, you know who smokes marijuana? Like, a lot of people.
I will tell you this. I've had people in this industry said, if marijuana was also banned out of competition, the UFC and MMA would be done.
Yeah, man. Most sports would be, bro. Like, okay, one, like, it's just a part of culture. And it's like, you know, it's I think I would be stunned if in 2027 or 2028, marijuana is like something that gets tested for in competition.
I tell you, I'm the ABC meeting is in Orlando this year in July. One of the things that I want to do go over there is I really want to do like a round table of executive directors, and marijuana is one of the things I want to talk to them about. You know, I mean, look, I you know, the limit for marijuana is high now for a majority of states, 150 milligrams per milliliter. With USADA, it's 180 milligrams per milliliter. But I would love, like, if it was like executive directors and Jeff Nowitzki and really have that conversation. I'm not a marijuana user, but I would love to have a conversation of, you know, I understand you don't want a fighter walking in high, you know, for a fight, just like you don't want a fighter walking into a fight drunk. But I'd really be interested to kind of hear the mindset and why the limit is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a fighter doesn't want to walk in high or drunk either. You know, it's one of those common sense things, but I think it's something that's definitely, you see changes happening, and I think the limit maybe is just fail safe for if a guy walks in high, I guess, but it's not a conversation that's front and center, the marijuana discussion. I mean, maybe that's just because Nick Diaz isn't fighting anymore, but it's just like, it's something where it hasn't really been resolved to the extent to where I think it will be. And it's good for you to bring it up. I look forward to see what he has to say.
Yeah. I mean, look, and I've been told by people, if the limit's 150 milligrams per milliliter, that you have to take part in marijuana the week of the fight.
Yeah, and I think, you know what? I think people should be able to take part in marijuana the week of the fight, you know? But maybe before the fight, you probably shouldn't light up. But it just doesn't feel very modern to have a fighter suspended or fined or punished in any way for smoking marijuana. Obviously, again, entering a fight high, drunk, inebriated, whatever, under the influence of anything is crazy, but something that will likely like hardly ever happen aside from a couple oddities.
Yeah, look, I don't expect that rule to change. By the way, speaking of USADA, I did find interesting that Uriah Faber is staying in the USADA testing pool and is open to a big opportunity.
Oh my gosh. Look, he probably will fight again. I just want to point out my time when we were having that discussion, I'm Central Time. It was 4:20 while we were talking about pot. That's I just funny. Wanted to point that out.
That's too That's funny.
That's amazing. Yeah, dude, your Uriah Faber's probably gonna fight again, man. Like one out of 100 fighters that retire stay retired. Moral of the story. And I think if you look at all these fight cards and you look at how so many of them are just very forgettable, Uriah Faber's a name, man.
No, he is. You know, and by the way, speaking of USADA, we got this question. The listener did not, they emailed this to me, did not leave their name. Just the header of their email address was JF1. And his question was this. He goes, USADA killable? Save cash in fights. IVs return. People make weight again. Fewer fights wrecked. Anderson Silva can fight again. Brock John Jones can happen when UFC is short on stars. Let's say Connor tested hot. USADA and UFC would work to keep the penalty to 6 months. Cyborg had an issue and they rolled out a special waiver since she failed to disclose a medical condition and medication. A time machine was rolled out for her. Tell us if any fighter can sell pay-per-view and has a belt. Special treatment is given. Cyborg too big to fail. Keep the needle in her butt. And that was the comment from JF1. In terms of USADA being killable, I think the answer to that question is absolutely no. I think if the UFC announced tomorrow that they were no longer working with USADA, I think they would be absolutely killed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just... It would be an asinine move, PR-wise. I think it's as simple as that. You talk about all the hits it's taken currently. Doing something like that would likely put yourself front and center of, like, why did you make such a move? And people would start investigating. And, yeah, it's just it's not a move I think they'll make. And it does seem like look, we've seen, obviously, the standards for fighters who are big money draws are much different than a normal fighter. It's definitely not a fair game, but I don't see something like that happening at all.
And I don't see USADA covering something up because of a fighter stature. I don't think it really matters to them at all. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, one of the things on the IVs, and obviously this is a big topic, the IV ban is, I think the best way to describe this is, the athletes of today are paying for what the athletes of yesterday did, and notably in cycling, the fact of they would use IVs to, you know, to cover up any banned substance that they may be on. You know, I think in terms of, you know, in terms of weight, I just, how about let's just have fighters fight at their walking around weight?
That would theoretically be what we would like to do, and I think it's as simple as we've pointed to it before. It's like, it's going to take a crazy idea, and the hardest thing about this crazy idea is it's not going to take that, but it's going to take every state applying it. So that would be amazing, but super unlikely. But it's something we got to continue to strive for.
Yeah, it's and we'll see what happens there. By the way, speaking of USADA, I want to play this clip from the Luke Thomas Show. As Malky Kawa was on talking about John Jones, it's about 2.5 minutes here, and you're going to hear Malky Kawa at the very end of it, or during this interview, say that he believes there's a 95% chance John Jones fights in 2018.
Yeah, by the end of this month, I think we'll get some clarity as far as what's going on. We've got a hearing with the California State Athletic Commission, which will be a big hearing, and we're hoping to get the investigation with USADA wrapped up by then also as well. Hopefully it all works out that way. If it doesn't, then, you know, I've got to tell you that I got to assume that by the end of March, for a fact, we'll get this thing resolved and we'll know exactly, you know, what it's looking like.
What would you say the percentage chance is that John Jones fights again in 2018?
I'd like to say about maybe 95% chance.
Wow. So you're very confident in his ability to return to the cage sometime after, well, sometime soon, I guess.
if USADA, if USADA is a respectable organization, which I think that they are, okay, and they take all the evidence and everything that they've compiled, all the interviews that they've done, and all the things that they've seen, okay, they know for a fact that John Jones was not cheating, and he was not intentionally taking any type of substance. I think they know that. I think everybody kind of can come to that a conclusion based on the circumstances of his situation. That's the most I'm going to say at this point because, you know, obviously it's ongoing and I don't want to piss those guys off.
Sure.
I'm not trying to make their jobs harder, but it's like I said from the get-go, and then John went out and got a polygraph test. And I've heard all the, you know, everybody shooting it down and this and that. It's not admissible. It's that the other. The truth is that, you know, when a guy knows he's innocent, he's going through every measure to try to prove his innocence. You know what I mean? You've got to look at it at some point and say, okay, listen, you know, this doesn't make sense. He passes this test 3 weeks before the fight. He knows he's getting this test this day. Why would he start messing around at this point? And then when they get the sample, it has a very trace amount of some banned substance that he's never heard of, never taken, right? Or intentionally taken, let's say, right? And then all of a sudden, you know what I mean, 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, he takes another test and he passes again as if nothing's ever been in the system. So you just don't know what it was. Did he eat something that contained it? Was there something he took supplement wise that took you that had it? Was it something that maybe, you know, was it a cream that we didn't get tested? Who knows? There's so many different things that could have had it in such a small amount that, you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense at all. So I think when USADA saw that and the UFC saw that, everybody started, you know, working to understand where this came from. And, you know, I think USADA has it under control, and I think that everything would work out all right. Now, if they come back with something some punishment that's crazy with no explanation, then, you know, I've got a completely different, you know, problem on my hands and a situation that, you know, we'll obviously deal with.
I feel like Malky is very optimistic. I've said this from the start. I think John Jones is going to get at least 2 years. I mean, at the end of the day, a banned substance was in his system, even though it was trace amounts. California State Athletic Commission has a hearing February 27th. You know, look, the UFC needs John Jones, but I would be very surprised if John Jones fights in 2018.
Yeah, me too. Not 95% sure. I mean, George Malky, Malky is talking like did I say George Malky? My bad. Yeah. Malky Call. George Malky is a Houston Dynamo soccer player. He used to play with Toros. Malky Kawa is speaking much like someone who is, you know, working for John Jones. And I will say, man, he's got me feeling confident about John Jones fighting at 2018. But, God, my BS meter does go off, man. To me, the strongest case is how trace amount, but I just have so little patience for one of the best athletes in the world.
Like, this is my thing. I mean, and I think, like, look, I don't think by any chance this is going to happen. I'm just throwing this out there. It's just pure speculation because that's what we do on podcasts, speculate.
Yeah.
Like, what happens if, you know, this thing gets thrown out? Like, what's that do to the light heavyweight? And look, as I've always said, no one misquote me here. I've always believed that I think he's going to get 2 years. But what happens if John does get off?
I mean, he gets a title shot. If he gets off, he fights Daniel Cormier, right? If he gets off in February, maybe not. But
I mean, is best case scenario 18 months?
No, I mean, best case scenario is he gets thrown out. I think that's the best.
Oh, I think best case scenario is it's only I think this is just pure speculation on my part. No inside information at all. I almost want to – does the Jones camp hoping that they only get 1 year from California and then that kind of is – that's the feather in their cap of, oh, you saw just trying to tear down athletes. I don't know. I just – the UFC needs John Jones. There's no question about him. But, you know, it's – you know, there is all – no matter what happens – there is always going to be a cloud around John Jones.
Yeah, I mean, the cloud is one that's going to really benefit George St. Pierre and Demetrius Johnson when it comes to best fighter of all time discussion. Because, I mean, Anderson Silva obviously is pretty much – you talk about a cloud. I mean, he's got a whole bunch of clouds around him and John Jones as well. So when you're making these cases of who's the best fighter of all time, it's much easier to go with the fighter – who doesn't have a track record of being suspended for taking illegal substances.
Yeah, it's no matter what happens, that's always going to be the cloud. I mean, you know, and we'll see how the thing plays out. I mean, I would still be surprised if USADA does not come back with at least a 2-year suspension.
Yeah, yeah, I would say this. I am much more confident in your outlook than Malky Cobb was. I feel like you have a little bit less bias here.
Yeah, I mean, he at the end of the day, he does represent John Jones, but that is everything that is going on in the world of MMA. Of course, coming up next week, going to be joined by Alex Reyes, Cody Stamann, and Andre Sukrunthaw. Of course, those fighters are all coming up on future UFC fight cards, but of course, also next week, we will recap Bellator 194 UFC Fight Night 126, and then, of course, next week it is UFC on Fox 24, Jeremy Stephens taking on Josh Emmett. Actually saw, I don't know if you saw this, Jeremy Stephens was on the, the Shannon Sharp
show called? It might be called Undisputed.
Yeah, that's right. I saw a clip come across my timeline. He was on there. I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
I don't think the show does well with the ratings, but hey, at least Jeremy Stephens getting a little pub time.
You talked to Skip Bayless. Pretty cool.
Yeah, but that'll be coming up here next week on the podcast. Of course, as always, you can always listen to this podcast, RadioInfluence.com, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. So that's good. I do want to thank my guests for coming on this week's podcast, Liam McGarry, Anna Hulleton, and Joey Sanchez. You can see all those fighters fight this weekend. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast that comes out every Wednesday morning on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Three police officers at 11 o'clock in the morning serving a simple traffic warrant shot. One officer shot in the head, all because this guy didn't want to go back to jail. Now, I don't care. I don't want to hear about mental health issues. I don't want to hear about any of that crap. This guy didn't want to go back to jail. He resisted arrest. Two officers called for backup. Another officer responded, and they were all shot, and one died. Yeah, there is a rash of officer-involved shooting, but it's involved on the officer. Yes, there's a huge rash of officer-involved shootings. Did you hear about it? You probably didn't, because there's only a rash of officer-involved shootings against suspects, right?
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.